Good evening. Thank you so much for coming. We have a lot. There's a lot of competition tonight. I know of Zavart. There's another speaker in the Young Israel. So I wanted to open up with just two things, just like a little bit of a review, but just a thought, maybe two thoughts of something that we've really covered in the past 2 weeks, and that is, you know, in the past. Really, for the past 2 weeks, we really only covered about 9 years of history. And if you just want to hit the next one, for the 9 years in Eretz Yisrael, there have been battles, there have been war, and it's just more than just one war. I mean, I think 9 years, the Afghanistan war wasn't 9 years. You know, the Vietnam War for sure wasn't 9 years. You know, here we know there were wars in Europe for 30 years war, but for 9 years of war is significant. Not only to mention wars against, you know, who against who. You're not really talking about two major, you know, world superpowers. You're talking about one superpower against a third world country. At least that's what it was. Until then, and you know, ragtime, you know, ragtag army, etc. I just like a little summary of what the wars were. The first, everything started in 166 before the Common Era, and that's the Greeks. That was that first, you know, the Greek that battle that Yehuda killed the 2000, where the real revolt started. The revolt started when they killed the Greek officer in Modi'in. But the first and they were doing skirmishes, etc. But the first battle that they faced, the Greek officers, Greek warriors, an army, was in 66 near the Gophna forest area. I'm not sure exactly where that area is, but it's a little bit to the north of Yerushalayim. And then it followed by a battle of Charon, and then Emmaus. And then when we get to the miracle, the battle of Beit Tsur, that after that battle led open that Yehuda was able to come back to Yerushalayim again. Until for 2.5 years, the Greeks really had control of Yerushalayim. They were doing all these to the base of Mikdash. They were worship totally filled with idols, and then Yehuda was able to get back only after 2 years of the war. And then afterwards it continued. It wasn't like, okay, now we got Yerushalayim, it's over. You know, we had another year. In that year, there were two rescue expeditions. You know, the Jews were in danger, and then following the rescue expeditions, Yehuda felt it was important to take vengeance on various cities around that did bad things. Whether it's in the port of Jaffa that drowned the Jewish community that was there, or the Idumeans that were in the south that were helping out the Greek army coming from the south to Yerushalayim. After that, then Yehuda started saying, "Okay, next one." Then once he had control, he started to attack the Acre fortress. Fortress, which was filled with Hellenized Jews and the Greek army in Yerushalayim. It was a fortress that was there. And as he started to try to weed them out, so then the Greeks came with another army. And then Beit Zecharia, and they lost that one pretty much. They retreated. You know, all they were able to do is, you know, they got to Yerushalayim ahead of the Greek army. They fortified the Temple Mount, and that's it. The Greek army was ready to take the base of Mikdash back again. And if not for the fact of outside factors, they would have been successful. But you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu plans. The whole world is all planned, you know, for the Jews. And something happened back at home. There was a fight for the rivalry for to be the emperor, to be the king of Syria, so they had to leave. But they weren't done yet. They came back again. A new emperor came in. New emperor, he says, "Oh, let me try." So he came back, and in 161, there were two more wars. I don't know how to say this this name, Kafir Salma and Adasa. There were two wars over here, and then after that, they finally sent another battle, another battle, and this was in 160. This was in Elasa. This was, in fact, where there was a this was the death of Yehuda. And it just then continued with the death of Yehuda. They followed the Chashmonaim all the way south. The Chashmonaim escaped somewhere south near the near where Masada would be today, but in that area, and because of all the sustained losses, they gave up that campaign. But in 57 they came back again for another battle. So I just and then there was afterwards, it was Yonasan who was then there, gave they were ready to give up and go back, and Yonasan made a sort of treaty. But I just want to just say, so for 9 years there's been battle after battle after battle, and I don't know what the losses were on the side of the Jews, but the losses on the side of the Greeks were very heavy, and I'm sure the losses on the side of the Jews were just as heavy, and it was taking a toll on the country. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu does this, and you'll see this in history, is Hashem has a certain hashgacha. Like, all of a sudden, after 9 years of war, Hashem is going to change the world over in order that they won't have these problems anymore. Like, all of a sudden, world events have just happened, and that era where the Jews are being persecuted, all of a sudden, the entire situation, political situation, is going to shift. And what happens basically in 157 of the Common Era is that there's a rivalry, a full-blown rivalry for the throne of Syria. And basically what happens is when that happens, so instead of the Syria trying to reconquer Yehuda, each of the rivals for the throne is now going to try to court Yehuda and try to get them to be on their side. So instead of fighting them, all of a sudden, each one is trying to outdo the other to try to get, at that time, Yonasan's support in 157. So here, the day before, the week before, here they were the enemy number one, and sending forces going ahead to kill and to try to take over the country. The next thing is, you know what, not only could you have your country, but you have your religious freedom, and I'm appointing you as the new Kohen Gadol, and we're going to lower your taxes. And this one says, oh, you're lowering his taxes, I'm going to make you ruler. And the other one says, well, you're going to make a ruler, I'm going to give you some land. And each one back and forth are going now to compete for the support of Yonasan, which was then, up until then, the enemy of the state. So this is something that Hashem, it's like an amazing thing. You'd never think, here there was such a desperate situation, and all of a sudden, with like nothing, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could just turn things around. There's another a very similar, I would say a similar situation, which really you could it happened in our times, after the 67 war. So Israel expanded itself, like it doubled itself for sure in terms of land that they increased. They got back the West Bank, and then they got back the Sinai, although they gave that away again, and then they got the Golan. Now, the border of Israel on its eastern side was bordering Jordan from all the way, the whole length of Israel, from the top to the bottom, bordered Jordan. And they had a problem, is that the Jordanians, the Palestinians, who were then the sworn enemies of the state of Israel, and I don't think things have changed that much in the past 40 years or so, but they were the sworn enemies, and what they kept doing is they kept sending terrorists over the Jordan River. Now, sometimes it's wider and sometimes it's not, but the border of Israel is such that it goes from all the way to the top all the way to the bottom, and you have to somehow patrol your entire length of your border. And Israel is not that wide. At some point, at some point it was only about 13 miles wide. That's before the war. But it only takes about an hour to drive from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. you know, even further down, so it'll take 2 hours. It's like a nothing of a country. It's very, very, very narrow country. And every day there were terrorists that were swimming across, or they were coming across from Jordan, and there was really no way of stopping this. And this started in 67 after the war, after the Six-Day War, and it was going on for 2-3 years. And it was just like, almost like, what do you do? How do you stop this? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu felt, I guess it was at the time, it was Hashem stopped it. And he stopped it. Does anybody know how he stopped it? It was something called Black September. I don't know if any of you remember. Black September was in September of 1970. Palestinians made one mistake. I mean, they make a lot of mistakes. But the mistake that they made here is that they try to assassinate King Hussein of Jordan. Now, maybe if you try to assassinate the Jews, they look the other way and they excuse it and everything. But if you try to assassinate another Arab, they don't play any games. And when that happened in September of 1970, when they made an assassination attempt on the life of King Hussein of Jordan, he went after them with a vengeance. And even today, we don't know how many thousands, they say maybe even tens of thousands of Palestinians, PLO, were killed by King Hussein. And to such a point is they were in such danger that they were swimming across the Jordan with the hands up to the Israelis. That's it. I'm on the next one, I think, right? They were coming across. They were swimming across. This isn't from 1970. It was a picture of it. But they were swimming. They were with their hands up. They were, because the choice was is now being killed by King Hussein or surrendering and going to jail or whatever in the Israelis. And they picked that with Israel. So after that, the border against Jordan was pretty much, or comparatively, it was quiet. I don't know throughout the years how many slipped across and how many terrorists came. I don't think it was, that's not where the terrorists really came from that point on. But it may have been, you know, every now and then. But the border stopped. And there's another example, a modern example of that idea, that, you know, you have problems and problems. All of a sudden, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with his own way, could just, like, turn it around and turn it over, and that's it. And that's what happened in the with the Hashmonaim. Here they were being in a terrible situation, wars, and it was destroying the country. And how much longer could such a country continue under these circumstances? Not only in economically, but physically and ruchnius wise, educationally, and all of a sudden, that's it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu with like overnight, all of a sudden, this person by the name of Alexander Balas, who looked like, you know, Antiochus IV, said, "Hey, I'm his son," like out of nowhere, and that turned everything around, and now that made a rivalry. And that rivalry now just, that rivalry all of a sudden just changed the entire situation in the Middle East. And like, yeah, I'm sure we can come up with other examples today. All of a sudden something happens and boom, the entire situation is changed. There's one other thing I wanted to just mention to you. Next slide. And that is, it's this Ramban that we mentioned by Yechi. The Ramban says in the pasuk when Yaakov Avinu was giving the brachos to his children, the Shvatim. So he mentions when it comes to Yehuda, he says La Yaser Shevet Mi Yehuda, that the scepter should not leave, the royalty should not leave the tribe of Yehuda, And there the Ramban says, he says, you know, the Hashmonaim, they were Hasidim, you know, to the nth, the highest degree. The Mesiras Nefesh that they did for Klal Yisrael, everything about them, there was only greatness. We're going to see maybe tonight already that the next generations we're going to have issues with the, you know, power corrupts, and we'll see what happens We'll see what happens with their children and grandchildren. But in terms of the original Hashmonaim, so they were Hasidim. And we've mentioned that every one of the five Hashmonaim sons, Matisyahu, he's the one that died on his bed. And not too many after are going to die on their bed. They're going to be killed. And it's and the Ramban asked the question. He says, why is it that the Hashmonaim died such terrible deaths? You know, after the heroes of Klai, so they saved Torah. Without them, there would not have been a Torah today. Would not have been able to exist if not for the Hashmonaim. So what happened? So he says, the Ramban says, it takes a Ramban to say this, he says that they were over, they went against Yaakov Avinu's wishes. And that's Yaakov's, it's not one of the 613 mitzvahs, that Yehuda has to be the king. The kingdom and kingship has to be in the tribe of Yehuda. It's not. It's like a wish or a bracha of Yaakov Avinu. And the Ramban says, because they did not follow this, the Hashmonaim being from the tribe of Levi, they were Kohanim, and they did not follow Yaakov's wishes, and that's why they had such a bitter ending. Rav Shiva, Rav Hanach Leibowitz asks on this. I remember he had a shmuz on this, and he says, "Look, what do you want the Hashmonaim to do? You know, the situation was never in a situation where there was peace in the world and everything was fine. The Hashmonaim were probably in the best position to go ahead and to galvanize the army, and their names struck fear into the hearts of the Greeks, and all the world we're going to see today that even from Sparta and in Greece they were all giving congratulations to Yonasan or to Shimon. So what do you want the Hashmonaim to do? You know, listen, you know, if we step down, what's going to be with Klal Yisrael?" So Rav Shiva says over here, he said in a shmuz in a few places, he says that in fact is, you know, the ends don't justify the means. You know, like a rabbi can't get up in shul and say, you all have to drive to shul so you can listen to me and become Shomer Shabbos. You don't, trot on the Torah in order to build up the Torah. And if there are situations, it's all a big shaila. Nothing is, there are shailas what to do if you have such a situation. But in general, the rule is the ends don't justify the means. If the Torah says not to do it, we don't do it. What's going to be with Klal Yisrael? Hashem is running the world, you know. Hashem wants to save Klal Yisrael, he has his way. That's what Rav Shiva said about this. But that is what the Ramban does say, that the Greeks, the Hashmonaim ended. And if you take a look here, 163, Elazar, he was the first one to kill, but with an elephant. Yehuda killed in battle of Elasa, 800 men against 30,000. They almost won the war, but they couldn't hold on. And Yochanan was killed in a mission when they were overrun, and they were overrun again after Yehuda's battle somewhere. At that point, they were he was on some mission and he was killed. And last week, I guess we will just pick it up over here, we mentioned that Yonasan was assassinated by Tryphon. That's what we're going to get back to our story now. So, if we just would continue where we're up to, Yonasan ends up, Bacchides, again, I don't know how to say the name so well, but they were the general of the Greek army. They had enough with the wars and everything, and basically they knew they couldn't get to the Hashmonaim, and they really give up and go back. And Yonasan makes, as he realizes that the Greeks were leaving the siege and stopping to get them, again, they were all out in the south somewhere in the desert, and he lost the general lost heart in the war. So Yonasan sends out a treaty. He says, "I'll tell you what, you know, you don't want to fight anymore, and we don't want to fight anymore. So you give us, good, on good terms, we'll make a treaty. you know, and we'll pay your taxes. And Yonatan had to send hostages to make sure that the taxes would be paid, and we'll return Greek hostages, and you don't come attack. And that worked. And Yonatan then was he was reinstated. Once that happened, so then Yonatan was able to come back into Yerushalayim. He wasn't able to. He was recognized as the Kohen Gadol, and things were going pretty good then. And this was under Demetrius. This is the Demetrius. We'll see again. There were two lines of rulers. They were cousins, and they were kept fighting each other. Well, that was once Yonatan got into power. So he was a very shrewd negotiator. He knew when, how much to give in, and what to do. He was recognized as Kohen Gadol. When he got into power, he started taking some land. You know, he opened for himself the Yaffa port. He got for himself. He took over the port, so they weren't landlocked anymore. And he also took over a place near Latron. I forgot what it was called back then. In order to something, we'll see. He got that area so that he has free passage. So it's protected passage. So he took a little bit. He had some extra. He took some land, and he got a dispensation on some taxes, and things were going pretty good. And he was ruling up until about 142 of the Common Era. And then what happened is, again, all the fortunes change. Things twist again. Demetrius is taken by a person by the name of Tryphon. And Tryphon, go to the next one. Tryphon was a regent for Antiochus VI. Now, Antiochus VI was the son of Alexander Balas. Alexander Balas is the supposed son of Antiochus IV. So, being that Antiochus VI was very young, so Tryphon said, "Hey, I'm his regent, I'm in charge. And I'm taking care of Antiochus," and he started a rebellion. He started to take over the country, and he was successful in his revolt against Demetrius, and he now had the country under his domination. Now, the nature of these regents, the people that are interested in power, is they're interested in power, and they usually don't stop with just a little bit. You know, they want power. So once he had power, I think he eventually kills Antiochus VI. But this is the regent who he's taken care of, when he felt that he thought he would get everything. But in the meantime, he's doing it all l'shem shemayim. He's doing it all for this kid. And he decides, you know what? We want Yerushalayim back again. We want Yerushalayim. We want Judea. We want it back again. So what he does is he starts coming down south with an army. And this is in 142 of the Common Era. When he comes down with an army, Yonatan starts to meet him up with an army. And Yonatan has a very significant army. And Tryphon realizes, and the rest is going to play out like a novel. Like it's like a back and forth. It's something. So Yonatan, Tryphon realizes there's no way he's going to beat Yonatan's army. So Yonatan doesn't really know that he's coming for bad. You know, it's, could be he is, he's not. What are you coming down for an army? You're assuming he's coming down for bad. Why else are you coming down with an army? So he's greeted with an army. But Tryphon sends a message to Yonatan. Again, they have this treaty based on Demetrius. You know, there's still like a treaty between the two countries, and Judea is paying their taxes, and they're not being aggressive or doing anything to start with up with Syria. Tryphon comes down with the army, and Yonatan meets up with him and says, what's going on here? And Tryphon says, oh, I don't mean to come and attack. What I'd like to do is, why don't you come with a small token force, and I'll come with my small token force, and we'll talk. And that's how he tricked Yonatan into coming and meeting him. And Yonatan, I guess, say falls for it. He didn't expect him to do what he did, and he came. He immediately kills all the people, all the guards, and he takes Yonatan, and he holds him as ransom. When that happens, so Shimon, who's the last of the brothers, finds out about this, and he goes ahead and he grabs, gets, you know, takes over the army. And Tryphon says to Shimon, listen, you know, you want Yonasan back? Pay me a ransom. So Shimon, in fact, gets the ransom. And Tryphon ends up killing Yonasan anyway and sends back the dead body. And Tryphon, I guess at this point, without Yonasan or whatever, he had a formidable force. And again, how HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how Hashgacha sets in, is that that winter that he was coming to take over Yerushalayim, or kept marching towards Yerushalayim, was a year of very heavy snows. HaKadosh, look, you know, and makes the snows, and he couldn't continue, he had to go back. The, you know, we know if, the year, the 1942, when the Germans were going after the, attacking, and they were deep in Russia, all the way down to Stalingrad. So they were one of the things. It was the harshest winter that, I don't know if that's on record, but for many, many years, and it was like 100 degrees below zero. And they say that did them in. That did the German army in. And I guess that's one of Hashem's tricks, you know, just throw weather out at them, and that's what happened. So Tryphon had to retreat. When that happened, Shimon immediately, what Shimon did is, you can go to the good, he makes an alliance with Demetrius. Now, Demetrius, too, again, is on the other side, side of the, I don't have it here, where do I have it? I guess we'll it's a few, I have two more to go. Okay, just forward two more for a second. Okay, so Demetrius too. Here was Alexander I. This is Antiochus VI. And this is where Tryphon was, all the way down here. He was the regent of this one. Now, Demetrius, Alexander Balas, overcame Demetrius I. And now what happened is Demetrius II, all the way on the other side, he was coming of age, and he was getting himself a power base. People, and therefore, when Tryphon went ahead and killed Jonas, and you could imagine that Shimon threw his support big time, in a very strong way, for Demetrius too. Okay, you can go back one or two. Okay, so now, go backwards, you're going forward, I think. Go back, the other way. Going back, one more, keep going, one more, that's it. Okay, so now, so we have... Shimon now comes. In fact, Shimon goes ahead. He supports Demetrius II. Demetrius II, in fact, kills Tryphon. Tryphon at that point killed Antiochus VI. He wanted to set himself up as the new ruler. Rome didn't like it. A lot of people didn't like it. Demetrius II made Demetrius' one son made a revolt, and Tryphon ran for his life, and he was killed somewhere, who knows, in some other country. So now Demetrius II is in charge. Demetrius II is, again, Shimon was his patron. It was Shimon supported him. And now things are at peace again. Shimon, Demetrius II acknowledges Shimon as the new Kohen Gadol. I guess they still had enough power to decide who was going to be Kohen Gadol, or he at least acknowledges as Shimon Kohen Gadol. Shimon comes at the with his army into Yerushalayim, with Demetrius II's blessing, and finally, and this is the first time since before the time of Hanukkah, for over 20 years, they finally are able to lay siege on the Acre fortress. And this is the first time that the entire Syrian, there's no more Syrians, that's it, he has the fortress of Yerushalayim. So up until now, there was always this fortress that the Jews had to contend with, and now that fell to Shimon. Shimon also got off, there was no more, with that fortress leaving, there was no more taxes to pay. He said, that's it, no more taxes. And this is at this time is when the Jews got their independence. And it wasn't until Shimon's rule. And, Shimon is given the title, he's called Nasi. And Kohen Gadol, I don't know what forever means, I don't know, I didn't see it in the Maccabees. But he was given the title of Nasi. Why? Because Shimon and his son Yochanan, Hyrcanus, they're both still sensitive to the fact that that kings only come from Yehuda, and therefore he only called himself a Nasi. Chavar HaYehudim, That's another title that he picked up. But Shimon would never call himself Melech. Neither did his son Yochanan Hyrcanus. The first person to call himself a king is going to be Yehuda Aristobulus, which is Yochanan's son. So now Shimon is in charge. Now during this period of Shimon, Shimon is now going to rebuild the country. He's gonna have 7 years total independence. And the country flourishes in this time, and he builds up, the Torah is being built up, and the economy is, there's no more wars, you're not giving your taxes away to another country, there's no foreign occupation. And Shimon goes ahead for the next 7 years, it would have been longer, but we'll see what happened, and he goes ahead, and the country is now flourishing, and it's a phenomenal, everything seems to be working great up until 7 years. And 7 years from now, Shimon had a few sons, and his daughter married a person by the name, I can go to the next slide. What do I have here? So this is, I just switched over here to what happened to Demetrius II. So now Demetrius II is the now new leader in Syria, and he executes Jonas' son. So Demetrius the second recognizes, we did already. Okay, and this is, I showed you, fine. Now, Shimon, when among the other things that Shimon does is, he goes ahead and he makes a treaty with Rome again, renews the treaty with Rome. Again, Rome is the up-and-coming force in the world, where Rome has not yet conquered the Middle East and the East, but they will soon. But nobody can make a move without Rome. As strong as, Rome watches everything. You know, if any one country is going to be too harsh or take over another country, Rome is going to be there and say, no, we don't like that, you better stop. They had Syria also forcing them that they couldn't have a navy, and at times they stopped them from conquering Egypt. So the Rome, they acknowledge Shimon as being the leader, and he also gets a message from the Greeks. And, he brings peace and prosperity. The next one is, he had a son-in-law by the name of Talmai ben Avuvi. Talmai ben Avuvi was a son-in-law. And what Shimon did is, he gave this Talmai, I guess, like a city. You rule a city, you want to rule a country, a city, and he gave him Yericho as a city to rule. I guess he felt that it wasn't the main part of Yerushalayim, the main part of Judea, but he gave him a city. Now, Talmai had designs on the throne. He thought that if he can get rid of Shimon, and he can get rid of all his brother-in-laws, he'd be able to go ahead and rule the country. Like, I don't know what he's thinking, but to that end, he went ahead and he made a deal, a pact, with the next ruler after Demetrius II. Demetrius II was becoming unpopular, and people started giving support to Antiochus the... I'm sorry, I take it back. Demetrius II was taken as captive. So Demetrius II was captive in another country, so his brother Antiochus VII was now the new ruler. So new ruler, new rules, right? So Talmai made a pact, a treaty, or a deal with Antiochus VII, and he said, listen, I'll kill out the family, and you come in with your army, and then you appoint me as the new ruler. I guess that was the game plan. So what did he do? He invited Shimon, his father-in-law, and all his brother-in-laws. He invited the whole mishpacha for a family simcha at Yericho. And they all came with the exception of Yochanan Hyrcanus. I don't know why he didn't come. He definitely at first didn't suspect anything. Anyway, they all came to Yericho, and Talmai kills them all. Kills Shimon, and it keeps Shimon's wife alive yet. And after he kills the sons, he sends out men to go ahead to kill Yochanan Hyrcanus. Somehow, Yochanan Hyrcanus was warned of all this. He goes ahead and he kills those that would plot to kill him, runs to Yerushalayim, raises the army, gets the army, and starts to go to Yericho and makes a siege around Yericho. In the meantime, Talmai goes ahead and he takes his mother-in-law, which is also the mother of Yochanan Hyrcanus, And he takes him up on the he takes her up on the roof, and he starts torturing her every day in order to get Yochanan to stop the siege. And the mother, Yochanan's mother, keeps screaming out, don't listen to him, you kill him, avenge your father's blood. And every day Yochanan had to endure the torture, the killing, the torture of his mother up on the wall. And he eventually would have gotten through to Talmai, except Antiochus VII went ahead and started to fulfill his part of the deal, which is he came and made an attack. He made an attack on Yerushalayim. So Yochanan and Hyrcanus had to lift the siege off of Jericho and take his army back to Yerushalayim to defend Yerushalayim. And when that happened, so Talmai left and he ran to some other country, never to be heard of again. So he lost out everything after killing out the whole family, with the exception of Yochanan Hyrcanus. Yochanan Hyrcanus is now the son. He is now in Yerushalayim, and he's now being attacked by Antiochus the Seventh. Right, that was the last one on my chart over here. And let's go on. So Antiochus the Seventh, he was Demetrius's rival. When in 138, when Demetrius is taken captive, so his brother Antiochus VII goes ahead, he attacks Tryphon, and who commits suicide, and now Antiochus VII is the king. Going back, okay. So now, what happens is Yochanan does something very interesting, or you wouldn't expect. He surrenders, so to speak, to Antiochus VII. He doesn't let him in Yerushalayim, but he says, okay, you want taxes? We'll give you taxes. We'll be subjugated to you. So he basically surrenders at that time to Antiochus the Seventh, which in retrospect was a great move, because Antiochus the Seventh is not going to last too much longer. And I guess Yochanan was, I guess, really biding his time. So Antiochus the Seventh leaves with Yochanan as now sort of whatever control he got over. I guess he realized, look, I'll take whatever he could from Yochanan. And within a short time, about 6 years later, Antiochus the Seventh dies. Okay, so 6 years later, Antiochus the Seventh dies. Yochanan then just breaks all the treaties and everything. There was no real strong ruler in Syria after that. As a matter of fact, for the next 20 years, it's just like one of these countries that nobody even wanted to conquer it. That's how bad it was. You know, they liked it there as a buffer between the East and the West. But finally, eventually, I think 20 years later from now, Rome is going to just swallow it up and include it in some greater other country that they take over. But you know, from being the most powerful country within 50 years, it was nothing. It's like gone. It's nothing left of that empire. So Yochanan now is free to. Yochanan now, after Antiochus VII dies, and now Eretz Yisrael is going to experience a new, even greater amount of expansion. Those were coins of that Yochanan actually did take. Now, before Yochanan started, Judea looked what you see in the green, and even the green area was Yonasan. Shimon and Yonasan. They first conquered Perea, this area here, and Shimon was able to conquer from Yaffa. And they got a little more of an area just to keep safe passage to Yaffa. Comes along Yochanan Hyrcanus, and he starts to expand Eretz Yisrael big time. And he goes ahead and he conquers the Idumeans. These were the allies to the Greeks. He conquers all the way up north, all the way to Samaria, and he takes more on the other side of the Dead Sea. And this is, he almost triples the size of Eretz Yisrael. Tremendous amount of expansion once they have more conquering the rules, once they have more room, so more Jews go ahead and they live in these areas. Also what he does, against the will of the Chachamim is wherever he conquers, so there's forced conversions. And now you're going to have a lot of slaves, Avadi Kananim, really. Eventually, either convert them or take them as slaves. Eventually, from the Idumeans especially, they're going to be part of the army. They're going to have they're going to be their warring tribe, and he's taking them as in the army. And eventually, Herod is going to come out from them. So this is the Yochanan's undoing. It's going to take a few generations until that all happens. But I just want to this is just bigger, what it looks like. Go to the next slide. Okay. What's happening now in Eretz Yisrael is we're having different sects, different areas. Now, Hellenists are out. They're gone. Hellenists are Greeks, and the Greek, once the Hashmonaim won and everything, if you were Greek, if you were Hellenized, you were out. That was gone. However, it was a new sect that was coming in, and those were called, we know them as the Tzedukim. Secularists, they call them the Sadducees. And the Sadducees, they were very much into Torah Shebaal Peh, Torah Shebaksav. They were against Torah Shebaal Peh. So just, they also became, they were also very from the, just talk about them in a second, but they were from the high class of societies. You know, they got their support from the wealthy class. They believe that only they should support, and they have the right to rule, and not the people underneath them. Almost like, you know, today you see the same types of splits. Then the Hasidim here, they put it down as Hasidim, but they were also known as the Perushim. Perushim was the overwhelming majority. Not like today, where, let's say, the Orthodox is, I don't know, what are we, 25%, 30%, depending on where, whatever country. But there, the Perushim, it was like 80%. Most of the Jews then were following the Chachamim, following the Sanhedrin, the Bezdin. And then, on the bottom, there's another sect that's starting to form, and they're called the Essenes. And they started to live in communes. They separated themselves out of the main society. They lived very ascetic lives. They just no ruch, no gashmias, all ruchnias. They wouldn't talk, and they would go to the mikvah, and they would punish themselves, and each maybe in a certain moderation, which would be good, but they took all this to an extreme. There was celibacy, and totally removed themselves from anything physical. They were very pacifists. The Chachamim were not pacifists. You know, they were just they were fully supporting the Hashmonaim wars. You see the later wars, you'll see that they weren't so into it. When Yanai HaMelech, maybe a little bit Yochanan Hyrcanus, but these were totally pacifists, and these really are the basis. The early Christians drew a lot of their support from these Essenes. The most famous thing about them is that the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in an area where the Essenes lived. The Dead Sea Scrolls was a scroll of Yeshaya, which is the oldest, it was about 2,500-year-old document of Yeshaya, which is the same as we have it today. It's just, that's one of the oldest scrolls that we have. Just the next one. So where did the Tzedukim come from? So the Gemara says is that Antogonish is Soko. This is the Mishnah in Perkei Avos. He says, Al tiyu amshamshin as a rav, al menas l'kal b'pras. You shouldn't be like a servant that serves his master to get reward, but you should be a shalom menas l'kal b'pras. You should be like a servant that serves his master not to get reward. They have Marashmayim Aleim, and you'll have Marashmayim, and you'll have fear of heaven. What ended up happening is they misunderstood what. So Antogonish and Soko had two Talmidim, Tzadik and Baisos, and they mistook what he said, and they said that there's no, on a very simple level, they said that there's no, that's it, there's no reward, there's no Olam Haba. And then they went off on and made a sect, and they said, and basically their sect was is there's no oral law, there's just the written law, just the Torah. And what the rabbis did, they made it all up on themselves, and the tzedukim, they wanted to keep things very, 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 very literal. And like two or three things is, first of all, it says ayin tachas ayin. So if you went to a tzeduki court, right, and you one person had blinded another person, so the tzeduki court with paskin, you got to blind him. Torah says ayin tachas ayin. Of course, we say ayin tachas ayin means the payment of an eye, for a payment of an eye. It says in the Torah, lo sevaru esh b'chomosh v'osechem b'yom haShabbos, you shouldn't make a fire in all of your dwellings on Shabbos. They took that literally. You can't have any fires. You see, this is going to be rehashed again much later. Another sect is going to come out. But at this point, there are no fires. Also, it says that B'yom Rishon, it talks about Pesach. It says Pesach came out, though the Omer would come out on Sunday. Yom Rishon, which is the day of Pesach, and the day after Pesach, which is on Yom Rishon, so they took that literally, and they wanted Pesach to come out on a Sunday. So what they did is, in order to confuse the Jews, in order to get Pesach to come out on Sunday, so they used to go ahead, and they used to, before the Tzedukim came about, there was a series of 15 mountains, and in one night, they were able to get to the community in Bavel when Rosh Chodesh was. Because when Rosh Chodesh in Yerushalayim, they established Rosh Chodesh, they would have like a certain color fire, a blue fire, or whatever, and it would light from one mountain to the next mountain, to the third, to the fourth, within one night. In Bavel, they knew when Rosh Chodesh was. And the Tzedukim came about, and they started playing with the fires. They started with, because they wanted it to come out, you know, that Pesach comes out on Sunday. And once the Chachamim realized that the Pesach was not, they couldn't rely on the system, so they had to, in fact, go ahead and change the system, and they had to use Edom. And then that's why today we have a two-day Yontif, because they weren't able to get to them by Pesach, so they had to keep a two-day Yontif. Also, with the no fires, that's one of the reasons why today we eat chalent. Because we wanted to show the tzedukim, you're supposed to have fire, and you're supposed to eat fire. You're supposed to eat warm food on Shabbos. They were just nothing, no fire, nothing hot. So just to show that they're wrong, they made it a mitzvah, you know, challenge. That's a challenge. So this is the culturally or whatever. This is the religiously. This is what's going on. And I think we are going to end over here. I think we're going to end here because we're going to see what's going to happen at the end of Yochanan's life and his sons. There's going to be a little bit of a who's going to take over on the who's going to be the next king in charge. So we're going to pick it up with the end of Yochanan Hyrcanus's life.